Good afternoon and welcome to Time Out, your program of informative interviews with persons of note, persons with fascinating careers, leaders of today and tomorrow, and others who will allow you to invest an hour and receive a guaranteed valuable return. So stay tuned. This is Bill Hendrickson, your host of Time Out on a cool and cloudy day in Carrboro, North Carolina. And we're going to have a terrific conversation, and you will be guaranteed a return from today's conversation because we are talking to one of the most well-known and successful collegiate women's golf coaches in the history of U.S. golfdom. Is that right, Dan?
I suppose.
The man I'm talking about is Dan Brooks. He is the women's golf coach at Duke University, and it's been great to read about him, and it's also been great to follow some of the successes of some of his golfers. So we're going to talk about golf. We're going to talk about coaching. We're going to talk about the world of the professional golf and everything that goes with it in the 55 minutes that we have. You've been here a while.
I have. I'm in my 33rd year.
Wow. Is that kind of common with golf coaches, or do they other kind of coaches seem to turn over more rapidly, like football coaches? And
yeah, I'd say it's probably more common than those other sports, but it's still a little bit uncommon for a coach to stick around that long.
Is this your first coaching job?
Yeah.
So you came right here to be the Duke coach from yeah. – How did they find you?
Well, I was an assistant golf pro in Boise, Idaho, and I did that for 3 years. And
so, golf was part of your life.
I guess. It was part of my life. Okay. I played golf at Oregon State, and then I didn't know for sure what I wanted to do. I really wanted to go back to grad school, but I decided to go into the golf business.
Difference.
Yeah, just to sort of because I had to do something and. After about 3 years, I realized that I liked the teaching aspect of it.
Okay.
And the golf coach at Boise State was a member of the club where I was at, and he knew that I was sort of chomping at the bit to do more teaching and that kind of thing. So he brought in this flyer that Duke had put out where they were looking for a women's golf coach.
And okay.
So that's how I found out about it.
Did Duke not have women's golf at all?
They did.
Oh, they did.
They had had it for... There was a guy named Ron Schmid,
okay,
who had coached the team for 5 years, and Jane Lloyd coached the team for a few years before that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ron Schmid became the director of the Iron Dukes.
Okay.
When Tom Butters became the
Duke names, folks.
Yeah. Tom Butters was our AD, and he hired Ron Schmid to head up the Iron Dukes.
So the golf coach job was open.
It opened up, yep.
And so... But they found you as an assistant golf pro, so you didn't really have any official teaching on your resume.
No coaching.
Yeah, that's what I mean, coaching, yeah.
I had taught the members a little bit, but there was really nothing to put on a resume.
So somebody must have given you a pretty strong reference to get the job here.
You know, I think it had more to do with not that many people applied. So I was very fortunate. And Tom Butters, I thought the world of him, and I guess he thought enough of me to give me the chance.
So okay, well, great. Well, getting started as a coach in a fairly major university, I don't know how Duke women's golf was stacked up in those days, but you had to kind of learn from the beginning as you were teaching the women.
Yeah, and back then, you know, I was hired to also be the men's assistant coach, and to also I was also in the PGA, the Professional Golf Association club professional part. So I was also helping to run the golf course. So Coach Rod Myers, coach of the men's team, and I ran the golf course and coach our teams at the same time. So it was a lot. It was a lot to do.
Yep. Was the golf course the same course that Duke has now?
Or?
Yep. Okay.
Yep.
But I don't know much about men's golf at Duke, so we won't talk about that today because we're here to talk about women's golf. But so how did you kind of learn your profession from ground up?
Well, you know, a couple of things about that. The expectations were lower then, too. We're a non-revenue sport. This is 1984 when I started. There were no assistant coaches on the in golf, men, you know, men's or women's. So there weren't, if there were any assistants, they were very few and far between. So it was a little bit more, a little less demanding, and most coaches wore more than one hat back then in a lot of the non-revenue sports. So that was good for somebody who had no experience getting a head coaching job because that wouldn't happen now. I mean, it's just very rare that I don't know if it would happen on either side that somebody would be hired to a head job at a major university after having no experience as a head coach. I don't think that could happen now.
So if you leave or retire sometime down the road, your replacement will have stronger credentials than you had when you came here.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So anyway, but learning to coach and getting the support of the golf players that didn't even know who you were, these recruiting too. Well, we'll talk about recruiting later on, but just
it was a challenge. I was 25 years old, and I had 10 women on the team, several of whom were seniors.
Okay.
So they were 22, and I was 25. Uh-huh. So there's a very similar age, and I'd never coached before, so it was challenging, but I also had a great crew. They were just a bunch of really great women on the team, and they really welcomed me in pretty well. There was, you know, there's some bumps in the road, but, you know, you hear sometimes about kind of rough situations that way where there's a new coach and they love the other coach and, you know, they don't really let the new one in. It wasn't like that. They were very mature about it, and I'm very grateful for that.
Well, has Duke overall been a support university for golf, for collegiate golf?
Fantastic. I've been supported. You know, I've had three athletic directors, Tom Butters, Joe Oliva, and Kevin White, and they've all been just absolutely wonderful to work for.
Okay. And so the other coaches of the so-called non-revenue sports have the same feeling about the university and its athletic interests.
I certainly believe so.
I mean, swimming and tennis.
I mean, there's if you look at Duke's coaching staff, there's a lot of us that have been there a long time, and I think that's an indicator.
Yeah.
You know, when coaches stick around, they're staying there for a reason, and we have a really warm feeling in the department. People stick around. We have, I think Kevin is highly respected by all the coaches.
Well, I wrote a letter to Kevin about 3-4 years ago because my grandson, as I told you, was on the lacrosse team, and I'd like to go and watch the lacrosse matches. And the stadium where they played the matches, Koskinen Stadium, was kind of old at that time. And I don't like to go up and down stairs without a railing. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a letter to him, and lo and behold, that particular summer they remodeled the stadium, and I feel very comfortable now going to watch lacrosse.
Well, he must have read your letter.
He probably did.
That's great.
Anyway, that's good support for the fans.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so back to your early days, reading about your early life as a youth in Oregon. Tell me about your family and this business about your grandfather.
My grandfather was a club professional, but in kind of the old-fashioned sense. He and his wife, my grandmother, lived in a small apartment that was attached to the clubhouse, which was attached to a 9-hole golf course.
You're kidding.
Kind of out in the boondocks on the Snake River in southern Idaho.
So go through that again. So they lived in an apartment.
An apartment that was attached to the clubhouse, which was a very small clubhouse. It's basically where you came in and bought your greens fee and maybe had a sandwich, but that's all
this
it really
is a public
amounted
course
to.
Like.
Yeah, public course. And they lived right there. So, and it was also, it's an interesting part of it, it was also a fishing establishment. You know, southern Idaho is a beautiful part of the Snake River Canyon. And so my grandfather would wake up every morning when the headlights hit the bedroom wall of the first fisherman that came down, that's what woke him up. And these guys came early. So by the time they got out of their car and went in to buy their ticket to fish, he was up and was able to wait on them. And it was the
So he was working in the clubhouse as not just doing golf.
They did it all. Yeah, they did it all. You bought your fishing license or your fishing ticket, your greens fee. If you wanted a golf cart, you rented it. If you wanted to get a lesson from him, you got that in there. And then he grew all the grass, cut all the grass, pulled all the hoses for the sprinklers, flood irrigated every week.
A one-man golf course.
It was him and his son, my uncle, pretty much that ran the golf course and every aspect. And my grandmother, she was the indoor person. And you know, he would get up and sell that first one, but eventually she would be the one
who made the sandwiches.
She made some of the food. There was a sandwich machine.
Oh, okay.
And she made all the milkshakes. Uh-huh. And I'm not sure she made a lot of sandwiches, but she
and do you live there?
I grew up in eastern Oregon, so this was in southern Idaho. This was near a town called Buell, Idaho,
uh-huh.
And that was in the Snake River Canyon. I grew up 4 hours away from there in eastern Oregon, and
uh-huh.
my town was Baker City, Oregon.
Okay, another jumbo place.
A jumbo place, yeah. About 9,500 people then, and it's about 9,500 now.
So, but what was your relationship with golf and your grandfather?
Well, you know, my grandfather was my hero, and he was my favorite person in the world, and so I was gonna be into golf, no question, because I called him Pop, and Pop was
just
all
the
about
Brooks side
golf.
Or your mother's side?
My mom's side.
Uh-huh.
So they tell me that I played my first round when I was 4 years old, but I don't remember it. And it was on that little golf course. It was on the golf course down in the Snake River Canyon.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So you would go visit in the summer?
Yeah, we'd visit probably 4 or 5 times a year. Summers were a little bit longer. We'd stay there for, you know, a week, maybe 2 weeks. When we got a little older, we started helping on the golf course. So then you'd actually stay and work, you know, in the summer.
And then did you get some instruction in golf from your grandfather?
It was always, they were
people?
Just little pearls of wisdom. It was never real formal lessons. But
yeah.
I'd hang on everything he said, you know. And he was somebody that didn't start playing golf till he was 33, and he wound up with a couple of course records. And
is that right?
Yeah, he got really good, very athletic guy, but got a late start in it. But he just sort of, you know, dug it out of the dirt. He figured it out. There wasn't anybody around there to teach him how to be a player. He just sort of figured it out himself.
Sounds like that old guy from Scotland who did it 150, 200 years ago.
Yeah, that kind of a thing. Yeah.
Well, okay, so how did you develop your own talent? Because you were a pretty good golfer in order to qualify for a coaching job.
Yeah, I was pretty good. I was never really a great player, but I got good enough to play pretty well in college and played in some.
So where'd you go to college in Oregon?
Oregon State,
uh-huh.
Yep. And, you know, I sort of had the same deal. There weren't a lot of great teachers around. I had my grandfather to give me a little input, but he was 4 hours away.
Yeah.
And so we just sort of figured it out, most of us in that part of the world. We'd watch TV, read a few golf magazines, read golf books, and we figured it out that way. And there was some frustration. And I think a lot of the reason I became a coach is because without a lot of guidance, I had a lot of motivation, a lot of passion for the game, but not a lot of guidance. And it wound up holding me back. You know, I didn't get as far as I would have loved to get. And a lot of it was mechanical. I didn't have the mechanical instruction that I would hope to have. And so I think that's been a motivator for me to sort of give people, you know, I want to help people the way that I didn't really get that.
You didn't get it for yourself.
I didn't get it for myself.
Well, we're listening to Dan Brooks, the women's golf coach of Duke University. It's great to hear these stories about the development of a person from nothing to with family help and you had your own personal motivation to do this, which is important, of course. So here we are now. Grandfather's gone. You've got this job at Duke. And you have a team. You said you had 8 women or 10 women on your team who were very supportive of you taking this job. But what do you do? How do you tell people how to hit a golf ball? I mean, I've been told by a lot of people how to hit a golf ball, and it never did me any good.
Well, that's a great question for those early years when I first got started. I had done some teaching, and I worked for a guy named Stony Brown in Boise, who was a good teacher, a well-reputed teacher. So I learned all I could from him. And I really, what I learned more than anything was that I did have this drive to sort of help people get better, and that I really enjoyed it. I love the teaching, and maybe that's in my system. There's a lot of teachers in our family, and so I just like the feeling and the process of teaching. When I took over this job, I realized, wow, I've got 10 players on this team, and
all pretty good.
And if I mess with their swings and we go to a tournament and they don't play well, that falls back on me. And so I've discovered that teaching a team is a great way to develop yourself as a teacher, because if your stuff doesn't work, if the stuff you're sharing with somebody doesn't work, you pay the price. Your team doesn't do well, and the finger's pointed at you. Mm-hmm. A lot of teachers aren't held to that sort of requirement. You know, your person shows up, takes a lesson from you, and then the person leaves. They're not competing. Yeah. They're not, you know, this way your feet are held to the fire. Mm-hmm. Whatever you're telling them, they're either not going to qualify because you didn't give them great input, or they're not going to play well in the tournament. So that was more incentive for me to stay with it, because I realized, wow, this is really, if I know my stuff, it'll show up with trophies in the trophy case. And so I've considered our program a developmental program, as opposed to just getting a whole bunch of great players and let them go. We've always tried to have this be a team where you're developing games and you're trying to make people better. You're helping them with their swing. And, you know, that's the way we do it.
Well, you say in the when I was reading about you that one of the complications is when you teach, when you give advice to a player, they take your advice, their game may fall off a little bit before the advice blends into their skill.
Absolutely. So it requires a lot of maturity on their part. They, at a young age, with the pressure they have on them, they've got to be willing to say, okay, coach me. I know I may take a step back while I try to learn these new skills, but I want to learn anyway, and I trust you to be sharing good information with me, and that I trust that it'll make me better. Now that, you know, for somebody that's 18 to 22 years old, coming in, especially when I was just starting out, that takes a lot of maturity on their part. And
a lot of confidence that you know what you're doing.
That I know what I'm doing. Yeah. And there were times that, you know, I needed to be confident, and at the same time, I needed to know that what I was talking about was good. And I know that a lot better now than I did then. So
I've never played golf with a woman. My first wife didn't play golf. I think she might have played a little bit, and the woman I'm married to now doesn't play golf. So what's the difference in men and women's golf, except for the fact that the tees are shorter?
Well,
because golf, to me, when I watched, I'll answer my question in just a minute, when I watch tournaments, which I watch every weekend, I watch something, and, you know, when you see them hit and swing and the ball flies, it looks like they're all doing the same thing.
Yeah. Well, they obviously, there's way more similarities than differences. I mean, it's from a mental standpoint, it's all the same thing, obviously. They're playing a game that is stationary. The pressure is the same. They don't think the same. I wouldn't consider a man and a woman to be the same as far as mentality goes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think anybody that thinks a little bit about women and thinks a little bit about men, they realize that there are differences.
Oh, okay.
Well, those differences aren't just going to go away because now we're playing golf.
I see. Okay.
You know, we all know women are different than men, and men are different than women. Those aren't going to go away because we're playing golf.
Mm-hmm.
So to characterize that, I would say that guys are going to be a little bit more aggressive with the way they play, maybe a little less thoughtful and cautious. And women are going to be a little bit more inclined to take the smartest conservative route as opposed to the route that will get you on the green with an opportunity to, for an eagle or a birdie. Mm-hmm. They may take a route that will get you certainly a par and maybe a birdie.
I see.
So you see what I'm saying? There are different approaches in golf that are going to show up, just like women and men take different approaches in life.
So if the man is more aggressive than a woman, he's going to take a club that may get him closer to that green.
And it might get him in the pond also.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You see what I mean?
Sure, okay.
Now, there is no right or wrong.
So the risks,
yeah.
Men take more risks, or the risky.
I would say that across the board, and of course, I am talking generalities.
Sure, so, I know, yeah.
But across the board, generalizing, men are going to take more risks. And if you talk to anybody that's been around this business very long, they're gonna agree with me on that. That with guys, sometimes you need to rein them in. And I've actually, with my team, had to embolden them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, you've got it. You've got this game. You've got this in your game. You mm-hmm. should feel comfortable about playing this shot. Whereas, you know, guys, you got to say, look, take it easy, man. There's a more conservative way to play this.
Uh-huh.
Let's go that route.
Who's the men's golf coach at Duke?
Jamie Green.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
He was actually an assistant coach at UNC.
Uh-huh, that's right. Yeah. Well, so you're coaching women who have been taught by family or pros in other places, overseas. We'll talk about your overseas work in a minute. When they come to you, how prepared are they for the world that you have for them?
And especially in golf, I think you get pretty well prepared as a junior. We call them junior golfers.
Uh-huh.
And you can get quite prepared as a junior golfer because it's not like a sport where you're playing. Even tennis is you have an opponent.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you get to college, the ball may be coming at you harder than you had when you were playing against kids your age as a junior.
Mm-hmm.
In golf, When you get to a golf course, you've got, I mean, the college golf courses are basically the same as the courses you played.
Yeah, okay.
You know, they may be a little bit longer, but uh-huh. for the most part, golf is golf. Mm-hmm. A golf course is a golf course.
And they have sand traps around
right.
the place.
Right, so it's not like they're going to, you know, and if you're on a team sport, like basketball, you come to college and all of a sudden everybody's as big as you are. Whereas in high school, a lot of the guys were smaller than you were.
Uh-huh.
But golf is golf. And, you know, we may play in a little colder weather than they're used to or a little bit longer golf course. But for the most part, they're pretty seasoned because they were doing the same thing as a junior as they're going to be doing in college.
What starts junior golf? How does it develop? Is it developing okay in this country? Or are you getting plenty of golfers?
I think golf is doing pretty well in our country. There's some great organizations. The American Junior Golf Association is probably the one that's best known amongst the better players, the better junior golfers. And they're nationwide, and they run some fantastic events, particularly for coaches that are recruiting at the elite level.
Mm-hmm.
We are able to go to, and see the very best players play against each other at these AJGA tournaments.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so, you know,
it's like watching high school basketball.
Well, the difference, though, if I go to a high school basketball game, it's very possible that my one or two players that are in that game, I'm there to watch them, but they may be better than the other players out there. When I go to recruit, I'll go to a tournament, and it may be packed with national and international players.
Really?
That are from all over the place. They're not part of
I see.
This high school playing this high school. they're individuals that came from all over, and they're playing against each other. So that's an advantage for us recruiting in golf, because we get to see players compared to one another right on the same golf course.
Okay, yeah, that's fantastic. Well, we'll get into recruiting. We're talking with Dan Brooks, who is the women's golf coach at Duke University. And, boy, I'm learning. I love golf. I think it's a great sport. It's a singular sport. It's you.
It is.
And that little white ball and that crazy thing you put a hit it with. I think when my father gave me a set of golf clubs when I went off to college. I went to a college in Ohio that had a golf course. Mm-hmm. And I think I had a driver and a 5-iron and a putter. And that's what I started with.
There's a few gaps in there.
Yeah. But, and I never, you know, I enjoyed playing, and I don't play anymore, but I really enjoyed playing. And it's such a unique sport because you can have two shots in a row. One is disgraceful and one is just marvelous.
Yeah.
So how do you get out of that disgraceful shot and make sure every shot is going to be a winner?
That has a lot. If you can master that, you can be a really, really good player. A lot of what we're trying to do is get players to save themselves emotionally. So, you know, if you get down, it's going to cost you. If you can stay up and make a mistake and forget that shot and move on to the next one, that's the name of the game. Such a huge, important part of this game.
So you talked about a minute ago about these junior tournaments. So they are big every year, I guess, and they move around like the professionals to different parts of the country.
Yeah, we've got where every week or two we're able to go to some really good tournament throughout the summer.
Okay, well, recruiting must be a big part of your job.
It is, yeah, and that's a part of it that has grown and grown and grown. The level of recruiting now compared to when I started 30 years ago, it's a lot more intense. And there's a crazy thing going on now where we're getting these early commitments, these people that all these young players that want to commit when they're very young.
Uh-huh. Like 12, 13?
Not 12, but 15.
Oh, really?
Definitely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they're ready to go. And I've never liked it. Most of my colleagues don't like it. But once you get a little bit of a panic going like that, then mm-hmm. it's hard to say what's causing what. You know, everybody's trying to make sure that they land a player before that player commits somewhere else, and the young players are panicked that they're going to lose an opportunity, so they're trying to get landed somewhere, find a home somewhere, and the whole thing is spiraling a little bit. So
I was looking at a list of college. We don't know much about colleges other than Duke, because college golf for women doesn't get much press coverage in local papers. Maybe it does. There's a golf magazine, I suppose, places like that that talks about college women's golf. But Stanford's a big golf course, a big college women's golf, and South Carolina. And I read one list just yesterday. You have the number one schedule rating for this year.
All right. You've been doing some reading, haven't you? Yeah, we try to always go to the strongest fields possible. And I think this year we are the top ranked, and that's been fairly often that we've had the best schedule. And I just think it's the best way to train your players.
Yeah, okay. You know. Well, we're talking with Dan Brooks. You folks are listening to WCOM. This is your community radio station in Carrboro, North Carolina. This is your voice in the community, and we are supported by many people and businesses in the community, and we are very grateful for that support. In fact, if we didn't have the support, the lights wouldn't be on, and we wouldn't be talking with Dan Brooks. You can go to our website, wcomfm.org, and make a safe and secure donation. We are a full tax-deductible nonprofit organization. Everyone here is a volunteer, and we really appreciate your support. You can come by here if you live locally, 300 Main Street in Carrboro, right in front of the world-famous Art Center, and stick a check in an envelope under the door, and we will give you credit for your contribution and mention your name even. So we are really grateful for that support, and we thank you for it. Now, back to our – I'm learning a lot about golf today. I should have talked to you when I was 30. you have such great players. Tell us about the recruiting process, because you have a lot of international players.
The international aspect of our team has never been by design. I didn't set out to bring in.
Oh, really?
No. I look for. I do everything I can to find people with great character, great physical games. You know, they need to look like they can play. Those things you were talking about when you have a bad shot, you know, I watch in recruiting to see if they recover from the bad shot and do they move on and get their chin back up and play hard, or do they let one mistake lead to another? You watch for those things in recruiting. And
well, when you're recruiting, you're talking about watching those things. Are you recruiting you and the prospect, or are you talking about the prospect in a tournament and you're just watching?
Watching them in a tournament.
Okay, yeah. You don't go one-on-one.
Yeah, so they're playing in a tournament, okay. And we coaches in our recruiting are walking the sides of the fairways, and we're watching them play. Mm-hmm. So I'm recruiting. I have only been out of the country three times. I've recruited out of the country three times in all the time that I've been doing.
Is that right?
With all the foreigners that I've had. So there's a lot of foreign players that come to the United States. They either come to play in our tournaments or they come and go to our academies. So there's like the...
Oh, you mean it used before to be, their college age?
Yeah. Uh-huh. It used to be the Leadbetter Academy. Now it's IMG Academy. So they'll come, they'll live here, they'll go to high school here. That gets them in this country. Now they play in our tournaments. We're aware of them. And you recruit somebody that's foreign. Pretty soon that player recommends another foreign player that they've played with and they've walked the fairways with. Golfers get to know each other. See, they're not across the net from each other.
I see.
They get to know each other. So now they recommend somebody and says that player.
But they're recommending a competitor.
A competitor, but I know her. I like her. She's really good. She beat me here. She beat me there. But I like the way she did it. She had great sportsmanship. So now they're recommending their friends, and those friends, by the way, are foreign. So now I get another player that's foreign. Now, I think character recognizes character. So if you have high character on your team and they tell you about somebody, mm-hmm. you want to listen mm-hmm. because they can recognize what good character is. So now I'm listening to my players, and pretty soon you're a foreign team.
Okay.
That's
and how many
works.
Foreigners do you have now?
Right now we've got seven people on the team. And
do you have seven people? Is
seven people on the team, and everybody, even though Miranda Wong is actually living in the United States now, but she was living in China not very long ago. So everybody on our team is foreign.
Right? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Everybody, not necessarily living overseas now, but
they're from another country.
From another country, yeah.
And so they're going to be playing on your team, and you got an Irish girl whose name
We have two Irish girls, McGuire.
McGuire, yeah.
Lisa and Leona McGuire.
Yeah, Leona. And I saw one of them in a tournament I was watching, but she took second place.
It was the British. I think she finished runner-up at the British. It was a European tour event, and it wasn't the British. It was a LET Ladies European Tour event. She finished runner-up.
She could have won. It seems to me she was close to winning, but something happened, and she don't know. And then the only one I followed it through my granddaughter, who was a next door roommate as a freshman, is the Italian girl. Virginia
Elena Carta.
Yeah, right.
She won the NCAA as a freshman.
Right, it's a freshman. Has that mm-hmm. ever happened before?
Not for us. Yeah, that was fantastic.
Okay, so you have these seven women on your team who all from overseas. What about the women who would like to be on your team? You have seven. Is that your limit? Is that all you can afford?
Well, seven's a great number.
Is that right? You were 10 when you came here.
And that was too many.
Is that right?
and I shrunk it right down. I mean, by they graduated, I didn't, you know, nobody.
Uh-huh.
They were a great group, and they just eventually graduated. And I said to myself, I really want to put my energy into the team that travels. So if you have if you travel with five, and if you have 10 people on the team, you're going to want to help everyone. And
oh, yeah,
so a lot of your energy goes into people who either aren't in the lineup or may be rolling in and out of that final spot,
uh-huh.
you know, trying to get in the lineup, but that may not be helping you win.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought a better idea, since we're a relatively low injury sport, why do you need 10 people? Why not shrink it down so your energy can go into the people that are going to help you win? And so we shrunk it down, and now you're given attention and working with games on the traveling team. And it helped. It proved to be a wise choice.
Okay, so these are all college students. They have to be in the college program. They have to go to class,
yeah.
and they have to major in something or other. But what's the educational style of these women? They come from another country. They play golf for maybe 4 years, and then they disappear. What's happened to them in golf as to relative to their careers?
Well, we've had a lot of them turn pro. You know, you've heard of Brittany Lang.
Right.
And she's just won the Open, so we've had some success that way. We've had a lot of success in other ways. We've got a couple doctors out there, a cancer doctor at MD Anderson.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, there's a lot of great success out there and a lot of families that have been built. Amanda Blumenhurst just had her second child.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's now after 33 years, there's quite a spread.
You got alumni. I imagine that they all come around occasionally to say hello and to cheer on your present team.
Yeah, they do. They've been fantastic. They're really behind what we do, and they pay attention. And the only other person that pays as close attention to us is you, Bill. You've really paid close attention. We appreciate it.
How about the men's side at golf? I don't know much about the
Jamie's done a good job.
Has he?
Yeah, he's got some really good kids and some talented kids on their team.
Has he had some kids that have gone into the professional ranks?
Well, Jamie's been there. Yeah, there's been quite a few players that are you know, Brinson Paolini and Julian Suri is doing a good job, and you know, there are quite a few of them out there. That it's tough, it's really tough, and so
yeah. What's the relationship tough wise between men and women's professional golf?
I think on an individual basis, it's all about the same. The thing about trying to be a professional on the women's side is that the amount of money, just overall the amount of money available, is less.
Oh, yeah.
So for you to make it on the women's side is just as hard as the men's side, because there isn't as much money. So you need to be much closer to the top to make a living
mm-hmm.
as a women player.
I see.
And guys, the money falls down a little bit lower. But the pool of talent is a little bit greater also. So it's comparing apples and oranges, really. But on an individual basis, what that player – I would argue that the player trying to make a living as a woman professional
mm-hmm.
is pretty darn similar to a player trying to make a living on the guy's side.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's hard, and
uh-huh.
it's really hard, and it's for different reasons.
Well, they're all on their own. I mean, when they go to a tournament, they have to pay their way, and I assume the tournament sponsor has some hotels available for things like that, but they have to pay their own room.
There's housing and
transportation.
You know, private housing, but it is a very expensive thing, and that's something that the players need to give a lot of thought about, especially these players that think about turning pro before getting their college degree.
Uh-huh.
They need to really think about what they're going to spend in the process of trying to make enough to go on and play the next year and the next year. It's a grind.
Do the manufacturing companies sponsor players?
Yeah, but women? That sponsorship.
You see, every player has some kind of a hat on or something on their shirt with the name of a company.
It's very difficult to get any sort of guaranteed money in golf. You're a rare case on the women's side, especially, to be guaranteed money to operate on. That's hard to find. You have to be a world beater, and then you have to network, and you have to have some luck too, and to wind up in a situation where you're actually having your golf funded by somebody, all your travel, all those expenses. You know, whereas if you're a top basketball player, you're going to be guaranteed money.
Yeah.
You know, right off. That's not the way it works in golf. Uh-huh. Most of the people that are turning pro and trying to make it in golf, men and women's side, are on their own dime.
Is that right?
Yeah, they're out there paying their own way. Or if they are getting something, it's a pretty paltry amount compared to what you're making in another sport.
Okay, so you've had women go into professional golfing. What's been the? Are you been satisfied with the results of generally speaking of the women that have graduated from Duke golf course golf program and gone pro?
Well, of course, my satisfaction comes from them getting their degree and becoming the people that they want to be.
Yeah. Well, you're the teacher.
Yeah, I'm the
that's
teacher.
Your teacher language
right.
talking.
So when I look at it, I'm not evaluating their lives based on whether they made it as a pro or not. If they had the experience that they wanted out there, and then I'm happy for them. If they got out there and they stayed maybe a little bit too long, and that ended up negatively impacting their lives, then I'm not happy for them. I'm sad that happened. And I don't really think that's happened a lot. I think the ones that have gone out there, we've had some success out there. Obviously, Brittany Lang is the one that stands out the most. Mm-hmm. Amanda, I think, was out there. You know,
I watched her every week when I would watch the list because her name was long and I could always find her name. But her name was always near the bottom.
Yeah.
She's closer to the bottom.
She struggled a little bit out there, and she was a three-time National Player of the Year.
Yeah.
It gives you an idea how tough it is out there. She was three-time National Player of the Year in college.
Uh-huh.
And you know, didn't do as well as she would have liked out there as a golfer. And she also discovered that the life was not quite as glamorous as one would hope. And I think she's having a wonderful life now with her two children. And
is she playing golf?
She maybe plays here and there.
Just
but
as
she's,
a f-
yeah,
just
she's not playing
socially.
Professionally anymore.
Yeah, okay.
And that may change. You never know. They've been, it's not the great thing about golf is that you can come back to it.
So you've won six NCAA championships as coach of Duke. You have been national coach of the year six times. You have been 10 times district coach and 14 times coach of the year of your Atlantic Coast Conference. So obviously you're right up there among college coaches, college women's coaches. Who are you competing with?
you mean what programs out there are really good? Well, the Southern California schools are always really good.
Uh-huh.
And Northern, you know, Stanford's an excellent program, UCLA, USC, you know, a lot of, you go right through the South, Alabama's uh-huh. a fantastic program, Florida, South Carolina has been really, really good, you know, they're a lot of the schools that you would expect to be really good, they're in the Sun.
Yeah.
However, Northwestern is really becoming a great program.
On Lake Michigan.
Yeah, then they're Northern, and Purdue won the NCAA championship not too many years ago.
Is that right?
Yeah, 2010, I think, maybe. So, you know, not that long ago. So
when you're in a tournament, how do you – now you have your seven teammates on your team now. How do you do it? How is a tournament run, just for the sake outsiders?
Tournaments have traditionally been run since I've been coaching, not going way back when it was match play, but it's been you travel with five, all five play each day, but you count four. You throw out a score every day. You only count four out of your five every day.
So there's 4 days.
There's 3 days.
3 days?
Yep. So you're every day you're taking the lowest four scores, no matter who it is.
The best four. Okay.
Best four, and uh-huh. it's stroke play. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the way it's been all the way up till a couple years ago. 2 years ago, and more, a year or two more than that on the men's side, three or four more years on the men's side, we went to a combination stroke play match play championship.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's right. I watch it this year.
Yeah.
They winnow out the teams and they end up with two players.
Exactly. So, you end up with eight teams that go into match play.
Yeah.
And those eight teams duke it out the last 2 days to see who's going to be the national champion.
You like that?
Well, I liked the purity of stroke play. I liked the fact that we played 4 days, and that's over 1,100 strokes. Now, you have that many numbers going in, you're going to pretty much crown your best team every year. Mm-hmm. There's not another sport that I know of that is that numerically definite on who the best team is. And so I like the purity. I like the fact that every year after 4 days of stroke play, we pretty much knew who the best team was.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you bring chance in, you bring match play in, you bring a lot more chance in.
I see.
And
okay.
So I don't like the fact that is it exciting?
Match play is really person to person rather than
person
team
to person.
To team.
And it just winds up that, if you have, for instance, if you have one player that's way better than the player she's playing against, you're only going to get one win out of that, even though that player crushed her. In stroke play, if you have a really good player, that's going to be numerically recorded. She's going to shoot a 64 or 65.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in match play, all that great player was able to do for you is get one match.
Mm-hmm.
She only beat one person. In stroke play, she may beat everybody in the field. You see how that works? And if you add that up over 4 days, four players counting every day, you got a much more definitive selection of who your champion is.
Okay. So all these good players, men and women, play below par. And they're either three, like that guy yesterday that won this thing in Honolulu won by like eight strokes or something, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you know who he is?
He's got a 59, I think, didn't he?
Do you know this guy, Thompson?
Thompson, yeah. Yeah, I know. I don't know a lot about him, but yeah. Another guy shot 62 on the same day and was three shots back.
Is golf getting to the point where somebody's going to shoot 45 sometime instead of 65?
No, but it is possible that 54, and it could possibly go a little bit below 54 if you – you know, a 54 would be birdieing every single hole.
Yeah.
And then you could actually have an eagle, a few eagles in there. So, but
what is it that's bringing these scores down?
I think my personal feeling is that we know the physics of the golf swing better than we ever have. We've got a lot of technology involved. There's a lot of great training and coaching going on out there.
The physics of the golf swing, not the physics of the structure of the equipment.
Well, I think equipment also, and that was going to be my next point. I think there is an improvement in equipment. I think that makes a big difference. But as we improve the equipment, the golf courses are stretched out. So I don't know if I could say the equipment is the reason as much as I would say that the repetitiveness of the golf swings, the ability for people to, if you watch Zach Johnson in the U.S. Open at Chambers Bay, and you look at the holes that he was on and the way he was launching that ball one time after another, dead down the middle with such small landing areas, I think there's more of that going on. There was always a few people that could do that, but now there's more and more people that can play at that level, that can hit the ball that accurately.
Well, the Opens, the national men's national Open. That's not PGA. That's a different structure, a different organization that does the U.S. Open versus the PGA.
Yeah, the USGA.
That's a different organization, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, the women's courses get shrunken in size for the women's.
Do they toughen up for the USGA? Yeah, the U.S. Open is probably the toughest venue that they will play throughout the course of the year.
Where are they playing this year?
Although they play it in, they played at Courtauld this year.
Okay.
Last summer.
Where are the men's playing this year?
Oh, coming up?
Yeah.
I can't tell you.
Okay. Where the women's playing this year?
Yeah, that Cordoval was last year. Actually, I'm not sure where. If I give it enough thought, I'll come up with it. I'm not sure. Where is the Women's Open coming up?
Well, that's all right. Well, now, but it's still, for you, it's still, it's an expensive sport for the college because you're sending people all over the world, but mostly all over the country that you have to, when they're in college, the university's paying for their travel. And
yeah, we don't travel out of the country. We do, every once in a while, there'll be an event out of the country, but it's rare. But mostly we're traveling with our team within the country.
Now, who goes with the team beside you?
My assistant, John Woodhouse. And two coaches.
Nobody else? You don't need somebody, a medical person? Or
no. When we go to the national championship, and we may take sports information. We'll have our strength and conditioning coach, Alex Merrill, and some support people. Jackie Seiler, my immediate supervisor, and Kevin White will come for the national championship. So when we get to postseason, then we start to see more people. And when we go to the ACC championship, we'll see them. So all the postseason stuff. But when we travel, it's just John and me, and we don't really need more than that.
Well, you've been here 33 years. You look like you're just out of high school yourself. So I assume you're going to be here for a while longer. And so Duke's very fortunate to have you.
I enjoy it. It's a great place to be. And I love being, around Chapel Hill, Carrboro, Durham, Raleigh. This is such a beautiful, wonderful place to live. Wouldn't have any reason to leave.
Yeah, that's good. Well, it's great to have you with us today, and you're going to have to leave in a few minutes. It's about time for me to start talking. But Rocco stopped by, but he's not talking. He's sitting silently to the side of us here. Rocco, is the host of our Saturday morning music hall, one of the most popular shows on WCOM, and Rocco, you used to play golf, didn't you?
I did. I used to play a little golf years ago, over 50 years ago, believe it or not. But golf's a terrific game. It's so popular, and you can get hooked on it. You really can. It's a pleasure to meet you, Dan. It really is. And
my
Bill,
pleasure
it's always
to be
a pleasure
with you guys.
To be on your show. Dan, let me ask you something. I've noticed in the paper a lot of the women professional golfers are coming from Asia now. There's so many Asian women that have turned pro on the ladies' PGA Tour, I guess. What has happened in the last 40, 50 years
Koreans
with that?
Koreans mostly, aren't they?
Korean or Japanese or Taiwanese, Chinese?
Well, I don't really know the breakdown of, the countries that they come from. There are a lot of Koreans. And I don't really know the definite answer to that. I've been asked that many times. If you dedicate to something, you have a lot of passion, you have a lot of reason to play hard, and you happen to be Asian, then you're going to wind up with a lot of Asians out there. So,
it seems that the American girls are just not as interested in sports to play in, maybe the way these other people are.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I think
you can ask the Department of State about. Well, we'll have our ambassador on here in a few weeks. You can ask Mike Cotter about that.
Ask Mike.
Anyway, I'd like to thank Dan for coming. I'd also like to thank some underwriters that we have for this show. I'd like to thank Tim Hux. Tim Hux is the CEP of Rising Tide, which is an organization that helps you understand your financial situation. He's a true friend, and you can count on him through good times or bad. I would also like to thank the Triangle Association of Health Underwriters. They are a group of professionals who will help you work your way through buying health insurance for you and your family, struggling through Obamacare or whatever we want to call it. I would also like to thank Mike Cotter. We just mentioned him. Mike is a retired ambassador. He's been on the show probably 12 times. Very erudite, very tuned into what's going on internationally, and we'll have Mike on soon to talk about the new administration. And I'd also like to thank a friend locally right here who says that she will support community radio until the end of time. And Rocco, you'll probably be here till the end of time, won't you?
I don't know about that one, Bill.
And next week, we'll stick with our Duke crowd. We had Connie Fullenkamp on a few weeks ago. We have Dan Brooks on today. And next week we're going to be talking with Mac McCorkle. We've had Mac on a few times. He was on with our congressman a year ago. And Mac will be talking about, we'll have a discussion, a post-inauguration discussion next Monday. When the inauguration will be 3 days old and people will be shaking their heads again or smiling or doing whatever they do after an inauguration. So tune in next week and to listen to conversation with Mike McCorkle. And how's your team going to do this year, Dan? One last question.
I think we're going to be okay. I don't want to, you know, put a monkey on our back or anything, but we've got some really good spirit on the team right now, good passion, and we had our first practice today. A bunch of them got out there. Our first official practice is tomorrow.
Okay.
But they're getting after it.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking the time to come over here, and we will be watching the score every week. And I guess if I read the Duke Chronicle, the Duke newspaper, I can find out what's going on in women's golf.
They always report on us, yep.
And so long until next week, folks. Thanks for listening.